when the hour of deliverance is at hand, as they did in Bismarck's time. We shall never have to fear any active resistance on their part, because of their recognized proverbial cowardice. It is quite different with the masses of our population, who are imbued with ideas of internationalism. Through the primitive roughness of their natures, they are disposed to accept the preaching of violence, while at the same time their Jewish leaders are more brutal and ruthless. They will crush any attempt at a German revival, just as they smashed the German army by striking at it from the rear. Above all, these organized masses will use their numerical majority in this parliamentarian state not only to hinder any national foreign policy, but also to prevent Germany from restoring her political power and therewith her prestige abroad. Thus she becomes excluded from the ranks of desirable allies. For it is not we ourselves alone who are aware of the handicap that results from the existence of 15 million Marxists, Democrats, pacifists, and followers of the centre in our midst, but foreign nations also recognize this internal burden which we have to bear, and take it into their calculations when estimating the value of a possible alliance with us. Nobody would wish to form an alliance with a state where the active portion of the population is at least passively opposed to any resolute foreign policy. The situation is made still worse by reason of the fact that the leaders of those parties which were responsible for the national betrayal are ready to oppose any and every attempt at a revival, simply because they want to retain the positions they now hold. According to the laws that govern human history, it is inconceivable that the German people could resume the place they formerly held without retaliating on those who were both cause and occasion of the collapse that involved the ruin of our state. Before the judgment seat of posterity, November 1918 will not be regarded as a simple rebellion, but as high treason against the country. Therefore, it is not possible to think of re-establishing German sovereignty and political independence without at the same time reconstructing a united front within the nation by a peaceful conversion of the popular will. Looked at from the standpoint of practical ways and means, it seems absurd to think of liberating Germany from foreign bondage as long as the masses of the people are not willing to support such an ideal of freedom. After carefully considering this problem from the purely military point of view, everybody, and in particular every officer, will agree that a war cannot be waged against an outside enemy by battalions of students, but that, together with the brains of the nation, the physical strength of the nation is also necessary. Furthermore, it must be remembered that the nation would be robbed of its irreplaceable assets by a national defence in which only the intellectual circles, as they are called, were engaged. The young German intellectuals who joined the volunteer regiments and fell on the battlefields of Flanders in the autumn of 1914 were bitterly missed later on. They were the dearest treasure which the nation possessed, and their loss could not be made good in the course of the war. And it is not only the struggle itself which could not be waged if the working masses of the nation did not join the storm battalions, but the necessary technical preparations could not be made without a unified will and a common front within the nation itself. Our nation, which has to exist disarmed under the thousand eyes appointed by the Versailles Peace Treaty, cannot make any technical preparations for the recovery of its freedom and human independence until the whole army of spies employed within the country is cut down to those few whose inborn baseness would lead them to betray anything and everything for the proverbial 30 pieces of silver. But we can deal with such people. The millions, however, who are opposed to every kind of national revival simply because of their political opinions, constitute an insurmountable obstacle. At least the obstacle will remain insurmountable as long as the cause of their opposition, which is international Marxism, is not overcome, and its teachings banished from both their hearts and heads. From whatever point of view we may examine the possibility of recovering our independence as a state and a people, whether we consider the problem from the standpoint of technical rearmament or from that of the actual struggle itself, the necessary prerequisite always remains the same. This prerequisite is that the broad masses of the people must first be won over to accept the principle of our national independence. If we do not regain our external freedom, every step forward in domestic reform will at best be an augmentation of our productive powers for the benefit of those nations that look upon us as a colony to be exploited. The surplus produced by any so-called improvement would only go into the hands of our international controllers, and any social betterment would at best increase the product of our labour in favour of those people. No cultural progress can be made by the German nation, because such progress is too much bound up with the political independence and dignity of a people. Therefore, as we can find a satisfactory solution for the problem of Germany's future only by winning over the broad masses of our people for the support of the national idea, this work of education must be considered the highest and most important task to be accomplished by a movement which does not strive merely to satisfy the needs of the moment, but considers itself bound to examine in the light of future results everything it decides to do or refrain from doing. As early as 1919, we were convinced that the nationalization of the masses would have to constitute the first and paramount aim of the new movement. From the tactical standpoint, this decision laid a certain number of obligations on our shoulders. 1. No social sacrifice could be considered too great in this effort to win over the masses for the national revival. In the field of national economics, whatever concessions are granted today to the employees are negligible when compared with the benefit to be reaped by the whole nation if such concessions contribute to bring back the masses of the people once more to the bosom of their own nation. Nothing but meanness and short-sightedness, which are characteristics that unfortunately are only too prevalent among our employers, could prevent people from recognizing that in the long run, no economic improvement, and therefore no rise in profits are possible unless internal solidarity be restored among the bulk of the people who make up our nation. If the German trades unions had defended the interests of the working classes uncompromisingly during the war, if, even during the war, they had used the weapon of the strike to force the industrialists, who were greedy for higher dividends, to grant the demands of the workers for whom the unions acted, if, at the same time, they had stood up as good Germans for the defence of the nation as stoutly as for their own claims, and if they had given to their country what was their country's due, then the war would never have been lost. How ludicrously insignificant would all, and even the greatest economic concession have been, in face of the tremendous importance of such a victory. For a movement which would restore the German worker to the German people, it is therefore absolutely necessary to understand clearly that economic sacrifices must be considered light in such cases, provided, of course, that they do not go to the length of endangering the independence and stability of the national economic system. 2. The education of the masses along national lines can be carried out only indirectly by improving their social conditions, for only by such a process can the economic conditions be created which enable everybody to share in the cultural life of the nation. 3. The nationalization of the broad masses can never be achieved by half measures, that is to say, by feebly insisting on what is called the objective side of the question, but only by a ruthless and devoted insistence on the one aim which must be achieved. This means that a people cannot be made national according to the signification attached to that word by our bourgeois class today, that is to say, nationalism with many reservations, but national in the vehement and extreme sense. Poison can be overcome only by a counter-poison, and only the supine bourgeois mind could think that the kingdom of heaven can be attained by a compromise. The broad masses of a nation are not made up of professors and diplomats. Since these masses have only a poor acquaintance with abstract ideas, their reactions lie more in the domain of the feelings, where the roots of their positive as well as their negative attitudes are implanted. They are susceptible only to a manifestation of strength which comes definitely either from the positive or negative side. But they are never susceptible to any half-hearted attitude that wavers between one pole and the other. The emotional grounds of their attitude furnish the reason for their extraordinary stability. It is always more difficult to fight successfully against faith than against knowledge. Love is less subject to change than respect. Hatred is more lasting than mere aversion. And the driving force which has brought about the most tremendous revolutions on this earth has never been a body of scientific teaching which has gained power over the masses, but always a devotion which has inspired them, and often a kind of hysteria which has urged them to action. Whoever wishes to win over the masses must know the key that will open the door to their hearts. It is not objectivity which is a feckless attitude, but a determined will backed up by force when necessary. 4. The soul of the masses can be won only if those who lead the movement for that purpose are determined not merely to carry through the positive struggle for their own aims, but are also determined to destroy the enemy that opposes them. When they see an uncompromising onslaught against an adversary, the people have at all times taken this as proof that right is on the side of the active aggressor. But if the aggressor should only go halfway and fail to push home his success by driving his opponent entirely from the scene of action, the people will look upon this as a sign that the aggressor is uncertain of the justice of his own cause, and his halfway policy may even be an acknowledgement that his cause is unjust. The masses are but a part of nature herself. Their feeling is such that they cannot understand mutual handshakings between men who are declared enemies. Their wish is to see the stronger side win, and the weaker wiped out, or subjected unconditionally to the will of the stronger. The nationalization of the masses can be successfully achieved only if, in the positive struggle to win the soul of the people, those who spread the international poison among them are exterminated. Five. All the great problems of our time are problems of the moment, and are only the result of certain definite causes. And among all those, there is only one that has a profoundly causal significance. This is the problem of preserving the pure racial stock among the people. Human vigor or decline depends on the blood. Nations that are not aware of the importance of their racial stock, or which neglect to preserve it, are like men who would try to educate the pug dog to do the work of the greyhound, not understanding that neither the speed of the greyhound nor the imitative faculties of the poodle are inborn qualities which cannot be drilled into the one or the other by any form of training. A people that fails to preserve the purity of its racial blood thereby destroys the unity of the soul of the nation in all its manifestations. A disintegrated national character is the inevitable consequence of a process of disintegration in the blood, and the change which takes place in the spiritual and creative faculties of a people is only an effect of the change that has modified its racial substance. If we are to free the German people from all those failings and ways of acting which do not spring from their original character, we must first get rid of those foreign germs in the national body which are the cause of its failings and false ways. The German nation will never revive unless the racial problem is taken into account and dealt with. The racial problem furnishes the key not only to the understanding of human history, but also to the understanding of every kind of human culture. 6. By incorporating in the national community the masses of our people who are now in the international camp, we do not thereby mean to renounce the principle that the interests of the various trades and professions must be safeguarded. Divergent interests in the various branches of labour and in the trades and professions, are not the same as a division between the various classes, but rather a feature inherent in the economic situation. Vocational grouping does not clash in the least with the idea of a national community, for this means national unity in regard to all those problems that affect the life of the nation as such. To incorporate in the national community, or simply the state, a stratum of the people which has now formed a social class, the standing of the higher classes must not be lowered, but that of the lower classes must be raised. The class which carries through this process is never the higher class, but rather the lower one, which is fighting for equality of rights. The bourgeoisie of today was not incorporated in the state through measures enacted by the feudal nobility, but only through its own energy and a leadership that had sprung from its own ranks. The German worker cannot be raised from his present standing and incorporated in the German folk community by means of goody-goody meetings, where people talk about the brotherhood of the people, but rather by a systematic improvement in the social and cultural life of the worker, until the yawning abyss between him and the other classes can be filled in. A movement which has this for its aim must try to recruit its followers mainly from the ranks of the working class. It must include members of the intellectual classes only insofar as such members have rightly understood and accepted without reserve the ideal towards which the movement is striving. This process of transformation and reunion cannot be completed within 10 or 20 years. It will take several generations, as the history of such movements has shown. The most difficult obstacle to the reunion of our contemporary worker in the national folk community does not consist so much in the fact that he fights for the interests of his fellow workers, but rather in the international ideas with which he is imbued, and which are, of their nature, at variance with the ideas of nationhood and fatherland. This hostile attitude to nation and fatherland has been inculcated by the leaders of the working class. If they were inspired by the principle of devotion to the nation in all that concerns its political and social welfare, the trades unions would make those millions of workers most valuable members of the national community, without thereby affecting their own constant struggle for their economic demands. A movement which sincerely endeavours to bring the German worker back into his folk community and rescue him from the folly of internationalism must wage a vigorous campaign against certain notions that are prevalent among the industrialists. One of these notions is that according to the concept of the folk community, the employee is obliged to surrender all his economic rights to the employer, and further, that the workers would come into conflict with the folk community if they should attempt to defend their own just and vital interests. Those who try to propagate such a notion are deliberate liars. The idea of a folk community does not impose any obligations on the one side that are not imposed on the other. A worker certainly does something which is contrary to the spirit of folk community if he acts entirely on his own initiative and puts forward exaggerated demands without taking the common good into consideration, or the maintenance of the national economic structure. But an industrialist also acts against the spirit of the folk community if he adopts inhuman methods of exploitation and misuses the working forces of the nation to make millions unjustly for himself from the sweat of the workers. He has no right to call himself national, and no right to talk of a folk community, for he is only an unscrupulous egoist who sows the seeds of social discontent and provokes a spirit of conflict which sooner or later must be injurious to the interests of the country. The reservoir from which the young movement has to draw its members will first of all be the working masses. Those masses must be delivered from the clutches of the international mania. Their social distress must be eliminated. They must be raised above their present cultural level, which is deplorable, and transformed into a resolute and valuable factor in the folk community, inspired by national ideas and national sentiment. If, among those intellectual circles that are nationalist in their outlook, men can be found who genuinely love the people and look forward eagerly to the future of Germany, and at the same time have a sound grasp of the importance of a struggle whose aim is to win over the soul of the masses, such men are cordially welcomed in the ranks of our movement, because they can serve as a valuable intellectual force in the work that has to be done. But this movement can never aim at recruiting its membership from the unthinking herd of bourgeois voters. If it did so, the movement would be burdened with a mass of people whose whole mentality would only help to paralyze the effort of our campaign to win the mass of the people. In theory, it may be very fine to say that the broad masses ought to be influenced by a combined leadership of the upper and lower social strata within the framework of one movement. But notwithstanding all this, the fact remains that though it may be possible to exercise a psychological influence on the bourgeois classes, and to arouse some enthusiasm, or even awaken some understanding among them, by our public demonstrations, their traditional characteristics cannot be changed. In other words, we could not eliminate from the bourgeois classes the inefficiency and supineness which are part of a tradition that has developed through centuries. The difference between the cultural levels of the two groups and between their respective attitudes towards social-economic questions is still so great that it would turn out a hindrance to the movement the moment the first enthusiasm aroused by our demonstrations calmed down. Finally, it is not part of our program to transform the nationalist camp itself, but rather to win over those who are anti-national in their outlook. It is from this viewpoint that the strategy of the whole movement must finally be decided. Seven. This one-sided, but accordingly clear and definite attitude must be manifested in the propaganda of the movement. And, on the other hand, this is absolutely necessary to make the propaganda itself effective. If propaganda is to be of service to the movement, it must be addressed to one side alone. For if it should vary the direction of its appeal, it will not be understood in the one camp, or may be rejected by the other, as merely insisting on obvious and uninteresting truisms. for the intellectual training of the two camps that come into question here has been very different. Even the manner in which something is presented and the tone in which particular details are emphasized cannot have the same effect in those two strata that belong respectively to the opposite extremes of the social structure. If the propaganda should refrain from using primitive forms of expression, it will not appeal to the sentiments of the masses. If, on the other hand, it conforms to the crude sentiments of the masses in its words and gestures, the intellectual circles will be averse to it because of its roughness and vulgarity. Among 100 men who call themselves orators, there are scarcely 10 who are capable of speaking with effect before an audience of street sweepers, locksmiths, navvies, etc., today, and expound the same subject with equal effect tomorrow before an audience of university professors and students. Among 1,000 public speakers, there may be only one who can speak before a composite audience of locksmiths and professors in the same hall in such a way that his statements can be fully comprehended by each group, while at the same time he effectively influences both and awakens enthusiasm on the one side as well as the other to hearty applause. But it must be remembered that in most cases even the most beautiful idea embodied in a sublime theory can be brought home to the public only through the medium of smaller minds. The thing that matters here is not the vision of the man of genius who created the great idea, but rather the success which his apostles achieve in shaping the expression of this idea so as to bring it home to the minds of the masses. Social democracy and the whole Marxist movement were particularly qualified to attract the great masses of the nation because of the uniformity of the public to which they addressed their appeal. The more limited and narrow their ideas and arguments, the easier it was for the masses to grasp and assimilate them, for those ideas and arguments were well adapted to a low level of intelligence. These considerations led the new movement to adopt a clear and simple line of policy, which was as follows. In its message, as well as in its forms of expression, the propaganda must be kept on a level with the intelligence of the masses, and its value must be measured only by the actual success it achieves. At a public meeting, where the great masses are gathered together, the best speaker is not he whose way of approaching a subject is most akin to the spirit of those intellectuals who may happen to be present, but the speaker who knows how to win the hearts of the masses. An educated man who is present and who finds fault with an address because he considers it to be on an intellectual plane that is too low, though he himself has witnessed its effect on the lower intellectual groups whose adherence has to be won, only shows himself completely incapable of rightly judging the situation, and therewith proves that he can be of no use in the new movement. Only intellectuals can be of use to a movement who understand its mission and its aims so well that they have learned to judge our methods of propaganda exclusively by the success obtained, and never by the impression which those methods made on the intellectuals themselves. For our propaganda is not meant to serve as an entertainment for those people who already have a nationalist outlook, but its purpose is to win the adhesion of those who have hitherto been hostile to national ideas, and who are nevertheless of our own blood and race. In general, those considerations of which I have given a brief summary in the chapter on war propaganda became the guiding rules and principles which determined the kind of propaganda we were to adopt in our campaign, and the manner in which we were to put it into practice. The success that has been obtained proves that our decision was right. 8. The ends which any political reform movement sets out to attain can never be reached by trying to educate the public or influence those in power, but only by getting political power into its hands. Every idea that is meant to move the world has not only the right, but also the obligation of securing control of those means which will enable the idea to be carried into effect. In this world, success is the only rule of judgment whereby we can decide whether such an undertaking was right or wrong. And by the word success, in this connection, I do not mean such a success as the mere conquest of power in 1918, but the successful issue whereby the common interests of the nation have been served. A coup d'etat cannot be considered successful if, as many empty-headed government lawyers in Germany now believe, the revolutionaries succeeded in getting control of the state into their hands, but only if, in comparison with the state of affairs under the old regime, the lot of the nation has been improved, when the aims and intentions on which the revolution was based have been put into practice. This certainly does not apply to the German Revolution, as that movement was called, which brought a gang of bandits into power in the autumn of 1918. But if the conquest of political power be a requisite preliminary for the practical realization of the ideals that inspire a reform movement, then any movement which aims at reform must, from the very first day of its activity, be considered by its leaders as a movement of the masses, and not as a literary tea club or an association of Philistines who meet to play ninepins. 9. The nature and internal organization of the new movement make it anti-parliamentarian. That is to say, it rejects in general and in its own structure all those principles according to which decisions are taken on the vote of the majority, and according to which the leader is only the executor of the will and opinion of others. The movement lays down the principle that, in the smallest as well as in the greatest problems, one person must have absolute authority and bear all responsibility. In our movement, the practical consequences of this principle are the following. The president of a large group is appointed by the head of the group immediately above his in authority. He is then the responsible leader of his group. All the committees are subject to his authority, and not he to theirs. There is no such thing as committees that vote, but only committees that work. This work is allotted by the responsible leader, who is the president of the group. The same principle applies to the higher organizations. The Bezirk district, the Kreis urban circuit, and the Gau, the region. In each case, the president is appointed from above, and is invested with full authority and executive power. Only the leader of the whole party is elected at the general meeting of the members, but he is the sole leader of the movement. All the committees are responsible to him, but he is not responsible to the committees. His decision is final, but he bears the whole responsibility of it. The members of the movement are entitled to call him to account by means of a new election, or to remove him from office if he has violated the principles of the movement or has not served its interests adequately. He is then replaced by a more capable man, who is invested with the same authority and obliged to bear the same responsibility. One of the highest duties of the movement is to make this principle imperative not only within its own ranks, but also for the whole state. The man who becomes leader is invested with the highest and unlimited authority, but he also has to bear the last and gravest responsibility. The man who has not the courage to shoulder responsibility for his actions is not fitted to be a leader. Only a man of heroic mould can have the vocation for such a task. Human progress and human cultures are not founded by the multitude. They are exclusively the work of personal genius and personal efficiency. Because of this principle, our movement must necessarily be anti-parliamentarian, and if it takes part in the parliamentary institution, it is only for the purpose of destroying this institution from within. In other words, we wish to do away with an institution which we must look upon as one of the gravest symptoms of human decline. 10. The movement steadfastly refuses to take up any stand in regard to those problems which are either outside of its sphere of political work or seem to have no fundamental importance for us. It does not aim at bringing about religious reformation, but rather a political reorganization of our people. It looks upon the two religious denominations as equally valuable mainstays for the existence of our people, and therefore makes war on all those parties which would degrade this foundation, on which the religious and moral stability of our people is based, to an instrument in the service of party interests. Finally, the movement does not aim at establishing any one form of state, or trying to destroy another, but rather to make those fundamental principles prevail without which no republic and no monarchy can exist for any length of time. The movement does not consider its mission to be the establishment of a monarchy or the preservation of the republic, but rather to create a German state. The problem concerning the outer form of this state, that is to say, its final shape, is not of fundamental importance. It is a problem which must be solved in the light of what seems practical and opportune at the moment. Once a nation has understood and appreciated the great problems that affect its inner existence, the question of outer formalities will never lead to any internal conflict. 11. The problem of the inner organization of the movement is not one of principle, but of expediency. The best kind of organization is not that which places a large intermediary apparatus between the leadership of the movement and the individual followers, but rather that which works successfully with the smallest possible intermediary apparatus. For it is the task of such an organization to transmit a certain idea which originated in the brain of one individual to a multitude of people, and to supervise the manner in which this idea is being put into practice. Therefore, from any and every viewpoint, the organization is only a necessary evil. At best, it is only a means of reaching certain ends. The worst happens when it becomes an end in itself. Since the world produces more mechanical than intelligent beings, it will always be easier to develop the form of an organization than its substance, that is to say, the ideas which it is meant to serve. The march of any idea which strives towards practical fulfillment, and in particular those ideas which are of a reformatory character, may be roughly sketched as follows. A creative idea takes shape in the mind of somebody, who thereupon feels himself called upon to transmit this idea to the world. He propounds his faith before others, and thereby gradually wins a certain number of followers. This direct and personal way of promulgating one's ideas among one's contemporaries is the most natural and the most ideal. But as the movement develops and secures a large number of followers, it gradually becomes impossible for the original founder of the doctrine on which the movement is based to carry on his propaganda personally among his innumerable followers, and at the same time guide the course of the movement. According as the community of followers increases, direct communication between the head and the individual followers becomes impossible. This intercourse must then take place through an intermediary apparatus introduced into the framework of the movement. Thus, ideal conditions of intercommunication cease, and organization has to be introduced as a necessary evil. Small subsidiary groups come into existence, as in the political movement, for example, where the local groups represent the germ cells out of which the organization develops later on. But such subdivisions must not be introduced into the movement until the authority of the spiritual founder and of the school he has created are accepted without reservation. Otherwise, the movement would run the risk of becoming split up by divergent doctrines. In this connection, too much emphasis cannot be laid on the importance of having one geographic center as the chief seat of the movement. Only the existence of such a seat or center, around which a magic charm such as that of Mecca or Rome is woven, can supply a movement with that permanent driving force which has its sources in the internal unity of the movement and the recognition of one head as representing this unity. When the first germinal cells of the organization are being formed, care must always be taken to insist on the importance of the place where the idea originated. The creative, moral, and practical greatness of the place whence the movement went forth, and from which it is governed, must be exalted to a supreme symbol. And this must be honoured all the more according as the original cells of the movement become so numerous that they have to be regrouped into larger units in the structure of the organisation. When the number of individual followers became so large that direct personal contact with the head of the movement was out of the question, then we had to form those first local groups. as those groups multiplied to an extraordinary number, it was necessary to establish higher cadres into which the local groups were distributed. Examples of such cadres in the political organization are those of the region, Gau, and the district, Bezirk. Though it may be easy enough to maintain the original central authority over the lowest groups, it is much more difficult to do so in relation to the higher units of organization which have now developed. And yet we must succeed in doing this, for this is an indispensable condition if the unity of the movement is to be guaranteed, and the idea of it carried into effect. Finally, when those larger intermediary organizations have to be combined in new and still higher units, it becomes increasingly difficult to maintain over them the absolute supremacy of the original seat of the movement and the school attached to it. Consequently, the mechanical forms of an organization must only be introduced if, and in so far as, the spiritual authority and the ideals of the central seat of the organization are shown to be firmly established. In the political sphere, it may often happen that this supremacy can be maintained only when the movement has taken over supreme political control of the nation. Having taken all these considerations into account, the following principles were laid down for the inner structure of the movement. A. That at the beginning, all activity should be concentrated in one town, namely Munich. That a band of absolutely reliable followers should be trained, and a school founded which would subsequently help to propagate the idea of the movement. That the prestige of the movement, for the sake of its subsequent extension, should first be established here through gaining as many successful and visible results as possible in this one place. To secure name and fame for the movement and its leader, it was necessary not only to give in this one town a striking example to shatter the belief that the Marxist doctrine was invincible, but also to show that a counter-doctrine was possible. B. That local groups should not be established before the supremacy of the central authority in Munich was definitely established and acknowledged. C. That district, regional, and provincial groups should be formed only after the need for them has become evident, and only after the supremacy of the central authority has been satisfactorily guaranteed. Further, that the creation of subordinate organisms must depend on whether or not those persons can be found who are qualified to undertake the leadership of them. Here, there were only two solutions. A. That the movement should acquire the necessary funds to attract and train intelligent people who would be capable of becoming leaders. The personnel thus obtained could then be systematically employed according as the tactical situation and the necessity for efficiency demanded. This solution was the easier and the more expedite, but it demanded large financial resources, for this group of leaders could work only in the movement if they could be paid a salary. B. Because the movement is not in a position to employ paid officials, it must begin by depending on honorary helpers. Naturally, this solution is slower and more difficult. It means that the leaders of the movement have to allow vast territories to lie fallow, unless in these respective districts One of the members comes forward who is capable and willing to place himself at the service of the central authority for the purpose of organizing and directing the movement in the region concerned. It may happen that in extensive regions no such leader can be found, but that at the same time in other regions two or three or even more persons appear whose capabilities are almost on a level. The difficulty which this situation involves is very great and can be overcome only with the passing of the years. For the establishment of any branch of the organization, the decisive condition must always be that a person can be found who is capable of fulfilling the functions of a leader. Just as the army and all its various units of organization are useless if there are no officers, so any political organization is worthless if it has not the right kind of leaders. If an inspiring personality who has the gift of leadership cannot be found for the organization and direction of a local group, it is better for the movement to refrain from establishing such a group than to run the risk of failure after the group has been founded. The will to be a leader is not a sufficient qualification for leadership, for the leader must have the other necessary qualities. Among these qualities, willpower and energy must be considered as more serviceable than the intellect of a genius. The most valuable association of qualities is to be found in a combination of talent, determination, and perseverance. 12. The future of a movement is determined by the devotion and even intolerance with which its members fight for their cause. They must feel convinced that their cause alone is just, and they must carry it through to success as against other similar organizations in the same field. It is quite erroneous to believe that the strength of a movement must increase if it be combined with other movements of a similar kind. Any expansion resulting from such a combination will, of course, mean an increase in external development, which superficial observers might consider as also an increase of power. But in reality, the movement thus admits outside elements which will subsequently weaken its constitutional vigour. Though it may be said that one movement is identical in character with another, in reality, no such identity exists. If it did exist, then practically there would not be two movements, but only one. And whatever the difference may be, even if it consist only of the measure in which the capabilities of the one set of leaders differ from those of the other, there it is. It is against the natural law of all development to couple dissimilar organisms, or the law is that the stronger must overcome the weaker, and, through the struggle necessary for such a conquest, increase the constitutional vigour and effective strength of the victor. By amalgamating political organizations that are approximately alike, certain immediate advantages may be gained. But advantages thus gained are bound in the long run to become the cause of internal weaknesses, which will make their appearance later on. A movement can become great only if the unhampered development of its internal strength be safeguarded and steadfastly augmented, until victory over all its competitors be secured. One may safely say that the strength of a movement and its right to existence can be developed only as long as it remains true to the principle that struggle is a necessary condition of its progress, and that its maximum strength will be reached only as soon as complete victory has been won. Therefore, a movement must not strive to obtain successes that will only be immediate.